This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. After a marathon round of contentious debates late last night and into the morning, Republican lawmakers have passed a number of bills that will limit the power of incoming governor-elect Tony Evers and Attorney General-elect Josh Call. The bills include a number of controversial moves, including limits to early voting and changes that may prevent Wisconsin from pulling out of a lawsuit challenging the Affordable Care Act. Sean Johnson is WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief. Sean, welcome back.
Hey, Rob.
Well, tell us how this all unfolded over the course of the night and the wee hours of the morning.
Over the course of the night, it unfolded largely behind closed doors as majority Republicans met in private caucus to figure out what they could support with these bills. And then, I think it was around 5 o'clock, both chambers of the legislature came in and started debating and passing this stuff. And, they both had to pass identical versions of these bills. And so they were both in there, almost a day after they were set to convene, or almost, 20-ish hours after they were set to convene. And they sent a lot of it to the governor's desk.
There were a lot of things they did pass. Briefly, what are some of the things that we've been talking about over the past few days since this stuff got introduced that they ended up dropping, they didn't pass?
Stuff they ended up dropping. So there was that provision that would have changed Wisconsin's presidential primary date and moved it from April to March. This was something that would have potentially benefited likely benefited conservative Supreme Court Justice Daniel Kelly in his first election in 2020. The thinking is that Democrats may have a competitive presidential primary in April of 2020. Republicans likely won't, and that turnout may favor them in Wisconsin's officially nonpartisan Supreme Court race. So Republicans were looking at moving that election date. A lot of clerks came out against it, said it would be a logistical nightmare, and Republicans eventually backed off of that one. So that one didn't happen. Something else that did not happen, there was a bill that passed the Assembly earlier this year that would have included or would have created state protections for people with pre-existing conditions. It was not as strong or as broad as the protections in the Federal Affordable Care Act. The Senate took it up last night or earlier this morning. All Democrats voted against it because they said it didn't go far enough. It would have allowed for lifetime caps on insurance. A couple Republicans joined them, and they viewed it as a mandate.
And then the idea of letting the legislature hire its own legal counsel to pursue lawsuits and things like that, taking some of the role away from the attorney general, did that end up happening?
That was amended, but that does exist in some form where legislators will now have more power to hire private attorneys to kind of sidestep Wisconsin's Department of Justice. So the range of what that could mean, we don't really know yet. I think you could imagine it could become an issue in something like redistricting, for example.
And the Office of the Solicitor General under the incoming Attorney General, were there changes made there?
I believe that is gone.
That is gone.
So, that was one of those that was amended pretty early this morning. But most of that bill is what we knew about, going into the session, or what we knew about over the weekend, let's say.
Now let's talk about some of the other things that did happen after getting through a lot of things that didn't. Early voting, what did we end up with there?
Early voting, there will be restrictions on early voting. So this was one that we found out about on Friday, and it would restrict early voting to the 2 weeks prior to the election. This is kind of similar to a restriction that Wisconsin had previously, that Republicans passed previously, but was struck down by a federal judge in 2016. So this is not exactly identical to the restrictions that existed in 2016, but it is close, and close enough that lawyers who handled that case have said they're going to bring this back to federal court and that somebody may end up in contempt of the federal judge's order in that case.
What kind of restrictions are we seeing now for incoming Governor Democrat Tony Evers?
A lot of it's going to be that he won't be able to undo waivers that the Walker administration has applied for and received over the years. And when we're talking about a federal waiver, we're talking about essentially permission from the federal government to do something differently. And these have applied to the food share program, to Badger Care, putting in a work requirement to get those benefits. Without these changes, Governor-elect Tony Evers could have come into office and rescinded those waivers and basically put those programs back to the way they used to be. With what they passed in the state assembly, that won't be possible. There is a restriction that's got a lot of attention in the last couple of days, and that would prevent Evers and Attorney General-elect Josh Call, as you mentioned, from dropping a lawsuit to overturn the Affordable Care Act. This is something that both Evers and Call campaigned on. I guess the widespread assumption was that this was something that they would be able to do because it's something that has always fallen as a decision to the Attorney General and the Governor. But under the bill that passed the Assembly and the Senate last night, those decisions would have to go by the legislature's budget committee before they could be final. So it would, in essence, give the budget committee, which is run by a 12-4 Republican majority right now, it would give that committee veto power over dropping a lawsuit like the one against the Affordable Care Act.
Talking to Sean Johnson, Capitol Bureau Chief for WPR, looking at the bills passed by Republican lawmakers as part of the extraordinary session over the last couple of days. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of all of this? Does this seem like a rebalancing of power between the governor's office and the legislature? Is that a good thing or a bad thing as you see it? Or do you think this is a power grab on the part of Republican lawmakers? And what do you think of the tone this might set for the next 4 years of divided government? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with WPR Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson about the extraordinary session in Wisconsin State Legislature. Bunch of bills passed early this morning. Want to give a listen to a couple key players here. First of all, defending this legislation, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss.
The situation that we are sitting in right now, if we do not pass these proposals, is that we are going to have a very liberal governor who is going to enact policies that are in direct contrast to what many of us believe in.
And at a press conference this afternoon, that governor-elect, Tony Evers, was asked about possible litigation on all of this. Here's what he had to say.
We need to have people reach out to Governor Walker, and then we'll take, if the next step needs to happen, all issues are on the table, whether it's litigation or other issues. We are exploring anything to make sure that this legislation does not get into practice.
Sean, before we go to our callers, let's touch on each part of that. Robin Voss has said, hey, this is a rebalancing executive legislative. There he's saying, we don't like this, what this liberal governor might do.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a long trend in Wisconsin that lawmakers have given the governor more power. I mean, there have been, duties that used to be under other constitutional officers that have been concentrated under the governor. And under Governor Walker, Wisconsin Republicans have been willing to give the governor even more power, especially when it comes to administrative rules or the fine details of laws. So that imbalance maybe does exist, but there hasn't been a push to curtail it in the way that we saw over the course of just 3 days here over the weekend. And, of course, that coincides with a new governor down, basically. I mean, this didn't happen during the Walker administration. It happened before Tony Evers took office. And so, obviously, that was a motivating factor, the motivating factor.
And then there's Tony Evers saying, if we need to, we'll go to court. So this could be a big year of legal battles, 2019.
Yeah, and I'm not sure exactly how that would happen, but you have heard multiple Democrats say that this is going to end up in court. I'm not sure where that would be or what specific provisions would be challenged. I think there's a pretty good chance that the restrictions on early voting will go right to federal court because there is a case on that that is actually still being appealed before the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, and you have a federal judge order that is potentially in conflict with the bill that they passed last night. I think one other area that could go to court, you've heard a few Democrats allude to this, is a separation of powers issue potentially with what they did with the Wisconsin Attorney General. That's a constitutional office. The Constitution doesn't prescribe a lot of duties for that office, but what Republicans are doing is, you know, restricting the power of that Attorney General in ways that Wisconsin hasn't done in the past. So that could be another area where the, you know, this bill ends up in court, where the legislature maybe gives itself too much power over the executive.
Let's bring on a caller now. Nancy is with us in Green Bay. Nancy, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. This has been a bother to me for the past few days, and I know that many people share my feelings on this. What this seems to me to be as if a mother would say to her children, you have to share, you have to give your brother that toy, and then before you hand it off, you make sure it's broken, so that, your brother really isn't going to be able to use it very well. And I don't understand, because this same legislature gave additional power to the Republican governor, and now stripping it away for the Democrat. How can people not be outraged by this?
Nancy, thanks for the call. We'll hear another voice now. Charlie with us in Platteville. Charlie, what do you think?
A similar opinion. I think three key words: sore losers, gerrymandering, and poisoning government. Poor losers in that they could see that perhaps Walker was not going to win. So they say that they looked at this much earlier, and they use the excuse to balance power. But it's blatant power grab. That's just a very false story. Secondly, gerrymandering. They gerrymandered the state of Wisconsin's electoral areas so that they would maintain control of the House and the Senate for as long as possible. And this actually delays or prevents the possibility of getting the gerrymandered state more reconciled to a more equitable division of areas of the state. And then I guess thirdly is it poisons the level of government. I mean, if people want to trust their government and then they see a party do this or a group of people.
Hey, Charlie, I'm going to jump in because we just have a few moments left. Thanks to Charlie and Nancy for calling. Sean, they reflect a lot of the reaction from Democrats in particular to what happened over the last couple of days.
Yeah, the trust in government issue in particular, this idea that, you know, Tony Evers and Josh Call ran on a pretty clear platform of getting out of the lawsuit, for example. And that lawsuit, by the way, would have gone on without Wisconsin's participation, but that is a pretty simple and clear-cut message that they ran on that it was not ambiguous, and it was the law, has always been the law, that they could do that. And under these changes, which were unveiled last Friday, that would no longer be the case. And so you've heard a lot of Democrats say, you know, that could have that's not good for the, you know, the general attitude of democracy. As far as the, you know, the gerrymandering argument goes, you've heard Democrats use that a lot over the weekend, that Republicans, that Democrats got 54% of the vote in legislative races, but Republicans got 63% of the seats. You've heard Republicans attacking Tony Evers, saying that the legislature needs to have a strong voice in these disputes with the governor, whose power base is in Madison. So kind of flipping that argument around and turning it on Evers, saying, hey, we're the real voice of the people that doesn't pretend for, you know, a harmonious legislative session next year.
We'll have plenty to talk about in 2019. Sean, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Sean Johnson, Capitol Bureau Chief for Wisconsin Public Radio, with us for the latest on the extraordinary session in the state legislature and what happens next. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. If you've got a bottle of wine sitting around your house, there's a good chance it's one of the big names, the Chardonnay or a Cabernet, Merlot, Pinot Noir. Those are just a few of the more popular varieties of wine. They dominate the market. A lot of them come from places you've heard of, France, the Italy, maybe California. But in a new book, our next guest dives into the world of wines you don't often hear about and finds a lot of variety, a lot of history, and even some prehistory to wine. Kevin Bigos is a former MIT Knight Science Journalism Fellow. His work has appeared in places like Scientific American, Harper's, and the New York Times. His new book is titled Tasting the Past, The Science of Flavor and the Search for the Origins of Wine. Kevin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, thank you for having me.
Well, you there's a line running through your book. You started on this quest, kind of, when you encountered this really unique wine in the Middle East. Can you talk about the wine that sparked this book?
Yes, I was in Jordan, of all places, in a just average hotel room, and there was a little bottle from Cremasan Monastery and Winery in Bethlehem. And I didn't know monks, this was 2008, 10 years ago, and I didn't know monks were still making wine in the Middle East, and I'd never heard of Cremasan. So I tried it, and it was a really good, very nice red wine. But I soon found out that you couldn't buy it in America. They had no importers, and I found it very difficult to find information out about it.
And you spent a lot of time tracking this. You found some big international wine experts who didn't even know the story behind this one, right?
Yeah, 10 years ago, even wonderful critics like Jancis Robinson, who wrote the Oxford Companion to Wine, hadn't heard of it. And then slowly people started paying attention, and everyone from scientists to Israeli winemakers to various experts. And it turns out they were using native grapes of the Middle East that may date back, you know, 2,000 years or more, with names like Hamdani and Jandali and Baladi. And that opened up a whole world to me, realizing that there were all these grapes I'd never heard of before.
Right. You write that in the wine industry today, there are some of those big names that people are familiar with, and a lot of wineries rely on those grapes and those kind of wines and just make their own varieties of them. But hidden underneath that, there's this huge, rich variety of local, regional grapes that most of us might never encounter.
Yeah, it's kind of like the equivalent of heirloom vegetables. You know, a lot of people have discovered old tomato varieties or apple varieties and things like that. And I didn't realize until fairly recently that the same thing exists for grapes, just wonderful grapes in almost every corner of the world. Assyrtiko in Greece, or Mariheftiko, or Himbeertje in Switzerland. And each of them has a unique flavor, which, and a unique story, of course.
Now, if people think of place that makes wine, probably a place like France is the first thing that pops into their head. You dug into some of the history, and actually it goes back before writing the prehistory of wine. As far as we can tell now, where did humans first start intentionally making and drinking what we would call wine?
Pretty much all the experts agree it was in the Caucasus Mountains, which would be the present-day Republic of Georgia or Armenia. And at least 8 or maybe even 10,000 years ago, they have some archaeological evidence from 8,000 years ago, and even some DNA evidence that suggests it was even farther back than that.
And that DNA evidence is a pretty cool new wrinkle on this. I learned in your book that these ancient jars that they used to transfer wine, amphorae, I think they were called, they can, even though these are thousands of years old, they can find traces of the wine that was being shipped in them?
That was astonishing to me. We know now that King Tut was buried with both red and white wine, and we know some of the flavorings the Egyptians used from the just the tiny microscopic residues that are left can now be analyzed in things called like mass spectrometers, and with high-tech equipment they can take one part per billion and sort of reconstruct what the original flavor might have been.
Talking to Kevin Bigos, his new book is called Tasting the Past, The Science and Flavor, The Science of Flavor and the Search for the Origins of Wine. Kevin, are we able to take those ancient wines and make something like them to taste the same something that, I don't know, some Egyptian dude 4,000 years ago might have been drinking and experience the same flavors?
I was surprised to find that in the Republic of Georgia and Armenia, they still make wine in those clay containers. They call them quevri. They're more teardrop shaped than the amphora that the Greeks used. But they've basically been using that same method for 8,000 years, and kind of like the equivalent of unfiltered farm cider. You know how farm stand cider is wonderfully cloudy and full of flavor? They make a whole different type of grape that's like a rustic wine, just exploding with a lot of different flavors.
You also look at some of the science behind wine, and actually humans aren't the only species that has to deal with alcohol, for better or worse. Fruit can ferment in nature, too, and a lot of other species have genes that allow them to, or not, to process alcohol.
Yeah, that I didn't realize it goes so far back genetically that birds and probably even some animals, too, you know, had a gene that helped them, you know, metabolize alcohol, you know, perhaps even 50 or 100 million years ago. You know, first things ferment all over the place, and yeast certainly goes back more than 100 million years.
Talk some about the science of how we taste wine. And I'm not a wine expert. I can't tell. I could probably taste, that one's white or that one's red. And that's as far as I could go. Some people are pretty sophisticated, though. Talk about the science of how we taste, how we experience the taste of wine.
Well, the more I looked into it, you know, some of it might be obvious is that people have different taste buds, and men and women often have different taste buds. There's some super tasters who are women who, you know, just have more taste buds than other people do. But it also turns out that just things like the music in the background and the lighting and the name on the bottle affect how we taste something. In other words, the scientists say the taste is really happening as much in our mind as it is in our tongue, because our mind says, hey, pay attention to this, don't pay attention to that. So really some of it's mental. And if you tell someone that they're drinking an expensive wine, they'll tend to have a better impression of it than if you tell them they're drinking a cheap wine in a blind tasting.
And even hearing maybe classical music, there have been experiments on that. What we're doing while we drink the wine can also affect our experience of the flavor.
Yeah, there was one tricky one where a supermarket alternated between playing French classical music and German classical music, and they had both types of wine stock, and they found that the background music had people shifting more toward German or French wines, depending on what was playing in the background.
Now, you talk to people who are, you didn't just dig into the prehistory, you talk to people who are currently making wine, and one interesting thing is the idea that, okay, we can take this wine, this grape that makes great wine in, I don't know, southern France, we can plant it here in California, say, and we're going to get the same kind of wine. And it turns out, no, there's a lot more to it.
Yeah, you know, grapes are really native to particular regions, just like, you know, citrus do well in Florida, but not in Maine. And we've tried to make these French grapes grow all over the world, and it kind of works. But, you know, there are all these local varieties that are better suited. And actually, there's some really good research in your region at the University of Minnesota where they're crossbreeding French grapes with Native American wild grapes and coming up with some entirely new varieties.
Now, there's a largely unspoken fear in the wine world about climate change and how that's going to affect their ability to produce the grapes that they rely on to make the wine. What kind of things did you hear?
Well, they're facing some really difficult challenges because, of course, Bordeaux and Burgundy and the Napa Valley are classic regions that, you know, are incredibly valuable. But the climate's already changing where, the Pinot Noir in Burgundy is already moving out of its optimal range of cultivation. So that means what do they do in 20 or 30 or 50 years? Do they move the winery, you know, up to Norway? doesn't quite have the same cachet. Or do they crossbreed, you know, these famous grapes with, say, a southern grape that has more, or a northern grape that has more cold hardiness or heat hardiness?
Well, another option you write about, and this is probably giving serious wine people headaches just to think about it, synthetic wine, no grapes involved in the creation of the final product. What is out there in the world of science?
Well, you might have guessed that it's coming from kind of the Silicon Valley area where people decided that, hey, you know, wine at its root is, you know, flavors are made up of different chemical elements. So they have manufactured some synthetic wine. It has not been greeted resoundingly by critics. And so far, actually, it's more expensive than the regular stuff. So it doesn't look like they're taking over yet, but they're still working on it. And theoretically, yes, you know, in 10 or 20 or 30 years, it might be easier and easier to duplicate particular flavors without having any grapes in it.
Now, you write about the Egyptians, the Romans, the Greeks had gods devoted to wine. You cite Christian and Jewish and Muslim poets in the Middle East writing odes to wine. As you traveled the world, where did you see cultures where wine was just really a central part of their lives?
More than anywhere else, it was the Republic of Georgia, which actually fits into, you know, the scientific theory that the place that's an origin of a particular plant or animal is where you'll see the most varieties. And supposedly they have 2 or 3 or maybe even 500 different grape varieties just in Georgia. And people have grapevines even in cities growing on their roofs and their trellises. And there's still thousands of peasants out in the country who still make their own wine at home in their cellars or in their barns. And, of course, also some very established larger wineries. But it's just everywhere in the Republic of Georgia.
Now, you experienced wine drinking in Georgia. Could we here in Wisconsin, in the United States, do we have an opportunity to try these wines from the birthplace of wine?
Yes, there are more and more good importers who are starting to, you know, import wines from Georgia and Armenia and even the Middle East, the Cremasan wine I tasted. You know, places like Astor Wine and Spirits will ship around the country. And even any good wine store in Wisconsin, you know, would probably be able to order a lot of these wines. There's a free tasting guide on my website that lists a lot of grapes. And, you know, just go to a good wine store or wine bar and ask them if they can find some of these for you.
Is it the same, though, to drink the wine that, you know, the person grew the grapes on their roof or, you know, the peasant out in the country, they grew the grapes, they made the wine? Is there something special to being there drinking it versus getting it out of a bottle?
There is something special to being there about it. And when I looked into that science and, you know, with the background music and all the subliminal things that are happening, I think when we're in a place with a tremendous story, whether it's wine or food or music, some part of us, you know, even expands and comes alive. So there's no substitute for, you know, being in the birthplace of wine, the Republic of Georgia, and drinking it there.
Kevin, thanks a lot for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Kevin Bigos. He's an author and former science journalist. He joined us to talk about his new book. It's called Tasting the Past, The Science of Flavor and the Search for Origins of Wine.